But what do I mean by people being marginalized? Probably seen that the responsible self in a marginalized community, I think, was on the board. What I mean by that is, I mean people who have essentially been left out, forced out of society, who have been exploited. Let me read to you how Julio de Santa Anna describes such a conversation with marginalized people in Uruguay. Quote, "Why do people defecate all around here? Don't you know it's bad for your health? Mister, you'd do the same if you had one lavatory a furlong away for 500 people. In a family planning session in a village, a woman talks, 'You asked me to limit my family, but I need children, more children, see? They're the ones who help me with the family income. If I want 3 children to remain alive, I have to produce at least 10. She is right. She lost many children, and she speaks from experience. Her children start working at the age of 5. Some roll incense sticks, bidis, or local leaf cigarettes. Some are in road gangs, pouring hot tar on crushed stones all through the day. For these children, there is no such thing as childhood. Everyday life is a continuous anguish for this family, not knowing where they are to live, when they will eat next. I do not bathe for months,' brags the man who gets his pittance as a laborer. 'I work the whole day in the hot sun and need water to wash myself. In this slum, we had water before, but now it belongs to the landlord who's taken over the place. Who can afford a bath if you have to pay for every pot of water?' A woman, after a lifetime of labor in the tea gardens, dies and is buried in the tea gardens in a cask made of tea chests. Over her grave will grow bushes of tea, whose leaves will refresh many. In life and in death, people like her could never hope for an identity that befits a human being." That's from De Santa Anna. Well, of course, the marginalized person described in that situation is what I would call the severely marginalized individual or community that has been essentially infantilized, is the term I use, which means they've been made into infants, essentially. That is, that as far as they are recognized by others in society, they're not entitled to adult respect. They do not have entree into the participation of the kind of public policy that controls their lives. Okay. In this system of marginalization, how do these people live morally responsible lives? That's what the book gets into. I have a second understanding of marginalization for people who are not quite as oppressed. I call it the marginalization of skating on the thin ice of white supremacy, because that's essentially my understanding of my existence in the United States of America. It is not that I'm unemployed, uneducated, have served time in prison, have been personally beaten by police, but rather, as an African-American male, I skate on a thin ice of white supremacy in a society in which any conflict that I may get into with a European-American citizen may result in a fissure opening up in that lake, and I may fall into the frozen depths of white supremacy, never to surface again. That's essentially what the Rodney King incident means for most African Americans. That is, that one may be driving along and one may really get into very serious trouble in this society because of who we are as a people and because of the history of the founding of this nation and because of the fact that conflicts in this country are usually resolved in ways in which the African American or other minority communities pay for whatever the conflict is. If you talk about environment, there's what you call environmental racism, in which the United Church of Christ has documented that most urban waste, toxic waste dumps, are in or around communities of people of color. You know, you just go up and down the line. What we're talking about is the question of the distribution of benefits and burdens, of merits and demerits, And essentially what happens for marginalized people is that we pick up the demerits, the burdens, and do not have the benefits. And this is in fact, indeed, the reason why we can classify ourselves in some sort of appropriate fashion, marginalized or oppressed. Now, to say that we experience this condition does not mean that we cannot act as moral agents. That's essentially what the book is all about. This is about people who were born in unquestionably marginalized or oppressed circumstances, who stayed within their communities of oppression and yet acted successfully as moral exemplars in the Christian tradition in those communities. So, I took about a year thinking about who I would have as moral exemplars. And then I began to think about people who had not been written about, whose voices really had not been heard, or had not been heard in several generations. And the three exemplars I have in this book are Ida B. Wells Barnett, who was a black woman who was a journalist who campaigned against lynching in the United States. And then I thought of Bishop Henry McNeil Turner, who was the first African-American chaplain in the U.S. Army, was a customs inspector, was elected to the Georgia State Legislature, and was a bishop in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, and who led a Back to Africa movement in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And then finally, I thought, having been raised a Presbyterian in my own background, being a black Presbyterian, Francis J. Grimke, who with his brother, Archibald Grimke, was one of the founders of the NAGRA movement, which was a precursor to the NAACP, and as was actually Ida B. Wells Barnett, who also contributed in the NAGRA movement. So what I wanted was to show how contemporaries, and these people are contemporaries, each dealt with the problem of being marginalized and suffering from white supremacy during an era in which people would have no question about whether or not they are oppressed. One of the problems I think we have in modern society is the notion of oppression in this country is a bit elusive. We look at somebody like Michael Jordan or Bill Cosby, or the heads of the Beatrice Food Group, one of the largest corporations in the United States, that is controlled essentially by an African-American family. And we say, because these people have made it in society, because they are usually multimillionaires and they are either well-known or very secure, that all problems in terms of oppression in our society have been overcome. And, you know, I'd be the last to say that there has been no change in American society. Indeed, I follow William Julius Wilson in the notion that the United States of America is less racist than it was prior to World War II, and that there is probably a lesser level of oppression in the United States from, say, World War II. To say that does not mean that we have trumped out the vestiges of oppression. I'd like you to take a look here, if I can ever get this to work. And of course, I do have high hopes. Let's see.
That's it. Probably go
down. Down, down.
It's a little bit.
Hey, will you move? Never, quote the Reverend, never more. What do I have to do, bring it back, perhaps?
No, it's not
working. Okay. That makes sense. See, this is the level of oppression we've gotten to. None of us can see anymore.
It's like I have my school back home. Somewhere in this range, there's supposed to be a focus.
Yeah. Okay, no, that was better, actually, not worse. Let's try moving it back.
Okay.
Oh, I see what the problem is. There we go. That's part of the problem, is it got off its stand. Now I'll try moving it up and down. See?
Okay.
All right.
I don't know.
See? Cooperation. Results.
and revelation.
Well, I think that's happened here. You can tell, thank you, you can tell that there has been an economic difference, okay, from 1969 to 1986. In terms of African American families, you have had a movement from the upper class, say 3% in 1969, to 9% in 1986. In terms of the middle class, there has been less movement. 25% in 1969, 27% in 1986, not much movement. Finally, working class poor has remained relatively the same. Don't seem to have that category for 86, but for 83, there's very little movement. Take a look, finally, though, at the underclass. In terms of the non-working poor, you have 14% in 1969, which those of you who are old enough to remember is still a very powerful economic boom that in the United States from throughout the 60s until 1972. The year, of course, I graduated from college looking for a job. But it's 83, look at the jump there. 23% non-working poor. And then in 86, the Reagan years, supply-side economics does work, and we have more poor people than ever, 30%. You have underclass and the non-working poor. Well, what do these figures demonstrate? I think what they demonstrate is that in America, anyone can make it. You can have your Bill Cosby, Michael Jordan, but not necessarily everyone can make it. The way that we have constituted our economic relationships and our social relationships. What is the answer? It seems to me that the answer has to be people working together to help other people meet their basic human needs. For us to see ourselves and our lives intertwined, to see ourselves as siblings, to answer the age-old question that Cain is asked in the Garden of Eden, asked to who is your brother, but to give a reply other than Cain's, not, I'm not my brother's or sibling's keeper or helper, but rather that I am. And so what I've essentially written about is that the lives of these exemplars, what they did, how they did it, to try and show how they can serve as examples for us in the future. And I'd like to just share a little bit with you, and then I'd like to open the floor for questions, and conversations, and criticisms. Let me just share a little bit with you some of the words of Henry McNeil Turner. Very interesting. How many of people have heard of Elizabeth Cady Stanton? No one here? She's the one who wrote The Woman's Bible, which was one of the first feminist interpretations of the Bible. And Turner, in 1895, noted her creation of that Bible and suggested that blacks do something similar, writing, "The white man's digest of Christianity or Bible doctrines are not suited to the wants, manhood, growth, and progress of the Negro. Indeed, he has colored the Bible in his translation to suit the white man and made it in many respects objectionable to the Negro. And until a company of learned black men shall rise up and retranslate the Bible, it will not be wholly acceptable and in keeping with the higher conceptions of the black man. We need a new translation of the Bible for colored churches." Well, what is the importance of that? It seems to me the importance of that for Turner is to recognize the relationship between sacred texts, between understanding one's religion, and between living one's life in a society. If religion is to be important, then it's very important how the sacred text explains your religion. As in, for instance, I'm not going to teach a class on the black presence in the Bible, But the black presence in the Bible has traditionally been suppressed. How many of you can name the unquestionably black author of one of the books of the Bible? Anybody? Just going to do a little quiz here. Okay, well, in Hebrew, Cush means person of black color, demeanor, skin type, whatever. And you have Zephaniah, son of Cushi. So that it's very clear that Zephaniah is a black person. Okay, this is something that's not really brought out very well in most of our Bible commentaries. You've had very strange translations. Compare your King James translation of Song of Solomon around the second chapter with a New Revised Standard Version, and you'll see the difference. Where Sheba, the Queen of Sheba, says, "I am black and beautiful," in the new version. And the second one, it sounds like in the King James, it sounds like an apologetic. "I am black, but beautiful. Somehow, even though I'm black, I'm also beautiful." You know, and of course, in the Hebrew, the conjugation is much more commonly translated "and." A very uncommon translation of that same conjugation is "but." So, you know, and there's a lot of that in the Bible. And what Turner did, besides his leadership in the church, was begin to get African Americans to understand themselves as being fully complete in and of ourselves. That was his real great contribution. And he did this in a marginalized community. He stayed among the people and worked among the people and pastored close to 50 years. And that, I think, is his great contribution, is to help African Americans to have a positive self-identity and to understand our task of self-determination. Now I'd like to turn to Ida B. Wells Barnett, who is the one who really stimulated me writing the book in general. I really didn't want to write about ministers at all. I wanted to write about African Americans who were solid Christian moralists in marginalized communities, whether or not they pastored a church or not. But in terms of historical figures and the preservation of the text, I couldn't find enough folks who had their words preserved. You see what I'm saying? It's not that they weren't moral exemplars in the community of that era, it's that their words have gone to heaven with them. But Wells was a journalist, and so we have her words. Now, in writing in reference to a criticism of Wells Barnett that she could not get people from the better sectors of the black community to serve as patrons in her enterprise to uplift the African-American community with a kind of black YMCA. The YMCA at the time was segregated, so she was trying to create an alternative young social club, and she couldn't get the social register in the black community involved. So when she was criticized for this, she replied, "Well, I would like to have had them. I certainly have done all I could to get them interested. But for some cause or other, they refused to come in. But then," I said, "neither did Jesus Christ have any of the leading people with him in his day when he was trying to establish Christianity. If I remember correctly, his 12 disciples were made up of fishermen, tax collectors, publicans, and sinners. It was the leading people who refused to believe on him and finally crucified him." That's Ida B. Wells Barnett, who in fact got not only the YMCA, began to have it integrated, but started her own social and youth group, although she had to give up leadership of it because she was a woman, and she submitted it to the males of the black church. So.
What a level, huh?
Huh?
What a ladder to climb.
Well, what a ladder to climb.
Oh,
what a ladder to climb. But I'd like to share with you one more quotation from Ida B. Wells Barnett. This is from later in her career. She had toured England and had brought to the English the reality of the severe lynching problems in the United States, to the horror, of course, of European Americans. But finally, by 1899, she had gotten married and she had children, and she had slowed down in terms of her crusade against lynching. Nevertheless, there were some people who had been accused of a crime down in Cairo, Illinois, and were about to be lynched. And in fact, one of them had been lynched, and she was going to go down there and try and bring that to light and see if she could get people punished. But she had been admonished by a lot of people in her community not to go, because a woman's duty, of course, is to take care of their children. Yet her husband, Ferdinand, insisted that she go. But she resisted his entreaties. Then she recounts what happened after she retired for the night. Quote, "I was awakened by my oldest child. He said, 'Mother, Pa says it's time to go.' 'Go where?' I said. He said, 'To take the train to Cairo.' I said, 'I told your father downstairs that I was not going. I don't see why I should have to go and do the work that others refuse.' My boy is only 10 years old, and he and the other children had been present at the dinner table when their father told the story. He stood by the bedside a little while and then said, 'Mother, if you don't go, nobody else will.' I looked at my child standing there by the bed, reminding me of my duty. And I thought of that passage of scripture which tells of the wisdom from the mouths of babes and sucklings. I thought if my child wanted me to go, that I ought not to fall by the wayside. And I said, 'Tell Daddy, it is too late to catch the train now, and I'll go in the morning.'" And that's from Ida B. Wells Burnett, who is, just to me, just outstanding in terms of the crusade she put up to erase lynching. But again, you can tell from the language, from the action of these people, that they had a deep and abiding relationship with Jesus Christ, and that they had a strong sense of call, that in fact they could act as an agent of God and transform the world, which is why they're worthy of writing about. Finally, I want to share with you a few words from Francis J. Grimke. And he was a communitarian, that is, a person who believed in the improvement of a community of people rather than so much a concentration on the improvement of the life chances of an individual. And so here's what Grimke wrote with regard to understanding social solidarity, the need for people to work together. And then I'm going to open it up to people to comment or whatever. But here's what he wrote. "The second thing that is perfectly clear to my mind touching our future in this country," that is in reference to African Americans, "is that as a race we are to sink or swim, live or die, survive or perish together. We can't get away from each other. Never mind what progress I as an individual may make. Never mind how intelligent or wealthy I may become. The social laws and customs that operate against the Negro as a class will operate against me. His fate will be my fate. We are all classed together and are treated alike, whatever our condition, rich or poor, high or low, educated or uneducated." That's his understanding of social solidarity. And I think that's a rather important one. With the understanding that we should probably look at what Grimke wrote and expand it to the notion that there is only one race, the human race, and we are all in it together. That where one perishes, we all perish. Where one is oppressed, we are likewise subject to oppression, and in fact are diminished by the death of any person. So that, in fact, what I put before you in terms of voices of the silenced is the problem in modern-day America for the middle and upper classes as well as for the so-called underclass. Namely this, that the problems of what William Julius Wilson calls the truly disadvantaged, that is, the people at the lowest rungs in our societies, for us as a nation, and especially for us as Christians, are our problems. That in fact, to the extent that we perpetuate the denigration of others, we call our own humanity into question. And that to the extent that we stand idly by and don't work for equality and justice in our society, that omission to act, that you might call it sluggishness, constitutes a social sin that will haunt us and haunt our children. And so, essentially what I'm trying to do now, share with people what I understand to be some of the problems in our society, and the primary one being moral, that is, taking on the yoke of Jesus, taking on the notion of having stronger moral ties rather than weaker ones. I've started a new book that's called Life Ain't Been No Crystal Stair, and The Ethics of Urban Survival, in which I'll be interviewing contemporaries in and around marginalized communities to see, in fact, whether or not the approaches to moral reasoning and praxis that the exemplars, the historical exemplars that I've written about, are still in use, what changes are there for marginalized people, and how, now that I've kind of laid out some of the theory, how in fact we can be better co-workers in the project of God, that is the project of liberation. And it seems to me that that begins with hearing other people, hearing the voices of the silence. So, that's kind of what that's about. And, you know, if you'd like to ask me more questions about it, or comment or criticize it, that's fine. How does this make sense to you, as I've laid this out? You've had a chance to read it, what do you think?
I guess what struck me most when I was reading the book was the fact that the three people that you used were not necessarily people that everybody knows about. And so, in that way, it showed me, you know, that there were people out there, God-loving people, who were doing what they could.
Sure.
And so, you know, so often we hear about people that everybody, you know, would hear about. And I appreciated that. Mm. And it showed me that I can be one of those people.
Thank you! That's the whole object of the book. It really is. That's one of the reasons why I got people who weren't well known. You know, it wouldn't make any difference if I got really well known people that we all know about and said, oh yeah, look what they did. I'm sorry, go ahead. Thank you though. That makes me feel so much better. No, you hadn't. And that does make me feel oh so much better. Go ahead.
I won't remember the people you referred to, but the first one, I think it was when they said, it was the woman on trying to get the YMCA.
Right.
And how she said Jesus' disciples were the fishermen or tax collectors.
Yeah.
And it kind of goes with that, something you can identify with. Because when you look at this whole problem, or any large problem, it just seems futile at a time, especially I feel in my life, because I'm so isolated from it.
Right.
But when you can relate to something, whether it's just a, although these people still seem very understanding, but it's still that connection that they were still everyday people, and they weren't the ones giving high publicity.
Yeah.
Or Jesus' disciples was a dog and fisherman,
yeah,
you know?
That's
there
true.
Wasn't any high profile. And you just think there's a place there that you might fit.
Yeah.
That it might work.
I agree with you. And that's the importance of it. Yes. Yeah. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, that was it. I just
when you think about the Gospel of Mark, most people, and particularly my New Testament professor came to the conclusion that Mark, one of the disciples, not a particularly well-educated person, actually did write the Gospel of Mark. And anybody who studied it in terms of Koine Greek realizes what, about 132 grammatical errors in the Greek. So it's not a person who was well-educated, but that's the writer of our Gospel. That makes an enormous difference in how we understand Christianity, that reveals to us what God wants us to know about the life and times of Jesus Christ. So yes, you know, publicans and sinners, and tax collectors, and people who are fairly economically responsible, they throw down their nets, leaving their father's business behind, and go off and follow Jesus. So yeah, that's a very important aspect of both this book and the next book that I'm going to be writing. I mean, you know, how many of us are going to be prime ministers, you know, or presidents, or are going to run a CEO? You know, most of us are going to do what we can in terms of our time and space. We'll provide perhaps some local leadership, maybe even on a state level. But most of us, not much beyond that. But what I'm essentially saying is that's more than enough. That's more than enough. If we can cause in our local communities changes in our churches and in how we relate to each other. And even in, you know, I don't know where you folks live. You may live in just what is known as a one middle class small town America. Mm-hmm. You know, you may not know any migrant farm workers. You may not know any cocaine abusers. You may not have slums. I don't know. For folks who live in those kinds of communities, I say, well, you still live in America. And one out of five children in America lives in poverty. So that I would suggest that you and I, we all have a responsibility in terms of public policy, because this is a democracy. And this is a wealthy nation. So that we can't say, the way a Russian peasant could, it's a czar's problem, and the czar has all power. I'm not responsible if other people are oppressed. We're in a democracy. And we can't say, like some democracies that are extremely poor, I mean, like, you know, to a certain extent, present-day Eastern India, which is a democracy, but they can't address a lot of problems because they're poor. We're both rich and democratic, which means that marginalization and poverty are problems that can be eradicated. And we can't really hide behind simply the enormity of the problem, is what I'm trying to say. Other, you know, impressions. Realize, you know, you didn't have a chance to read the book, but kind of the approach I'm trying to put forth.
It's become really clear to me that the church is it's kind of blind to the gospel and the intent of Christ's life to, and how can we look at ourselves with that? We've created God in some Western civilization image, and we know about, you know, the races, and we know about brotherhood. Uh-huh. We know about caring and compassion and so forth, but we as a church are no different than any cut of society, I don't think. I don't understand how we can, I mean, I think it was Gandhi said, you know, he said the problem with Christians is they don't follow Christ. And, you know, you think about it.
That's a good one.
Yeah. I don't understand how we can how we can tolerate ourselves to be so intolerant.
We don't live it. We don't live Christianity.
No.
There's very few people I'm finding that live it.
Okay.
Christianity, and that came out in one of the sessions that I've been doing with the Jews. Christianity is based on a belief instead of a way of life. And too many have gone away from living Christianity, and we need to get back to that. Starting in our homes, with the children, with our churches, with our neighbors. And to me, from the things that, the classes that I've attended with you, it all comes back to that. You have to start caring again.
Yeah. Yeah, and see, I think you've hit on it. The problem is not just human ideation. That is, the system of ideas, although there's some problems up there, there's some screwy stuff up there. The problem is human behavior and praxis. You know, I've never essentially been in or around a European American church where people weren't familiar with the song, you know, red or yellow, black or white, we are precious in His sight. Yeah. Jesus loves the little children of the world. And in every European American church, practically, and there are some exceptions I've been at, I know for a fact that in terms of how the church would be integrated, there would be enormous resentment in terms of these children that Jesus loved, if too many of them became members of Him. You know, there's a divorce, in particularly in Western Christianity, between the ideation and the praxis. And the problem is this, and it really goes back to German and Greek idealism, which is the notion that first you have to put out an idea, and then, you know, you work on the idea, you perfect the idea, and somewhere along the line, somehow, the practices, the relationships, the organizations, the institutions will somehow mirror the idea, rather than the notion of, let's examine what social relationships we have, what organizations we have, what institutions are operating now, and see how we can improve them. You know, with some sort of notion, I'm not against idealism completely, but the problem is, in fact, even the word idealism has taken on a bad tint. You know, he's an idealist, which really is a euphemism of saying he's a utopianist or he's impractical. You know. Rather than to say that he's a person who has a better idea about how society should be, and is also taking certain kinds of strategic steps along with others, and encouraging others to do it to bring that realization about. You know, it's the notion of, really, the best social commentator, I hate to admit it, in the 20th century, that's an American, is King, on the notion of the creation of a beloved community. But you don't have that notion played with in terms of our political process. Nobody's talking about creating a beloved community anymore. A little bit from Jesse Jackson on the notion of the Rainbow Coalition. You hear echoes of it. Echoes. But it's not the same as I think King's beloved community.
But we really, you know, I think the wind has been taken out of a lot of sails since ringing. I mean, beginning earlier, I think it was, cited ringing, but I think it was a reflection of what you're, you know, I just see the intolerance and a lot of the things that were progressing being dismantled and, saddens me.
Yeah.
They've been going on for a long time, though.
Yeah.
They've just walked in the
way. Yeah, I look back a little bit further at 68 and see the Humphrey Nixon election as a clear declaration. Because Nixon is a more interesting figure in a way. Nixon basically used code words to let white urban ethnics know that whatever changes in society taking place, they would have kind of reserve spot, and there would be rollbacks. From Nixon forward, you find affirmative action increasingly attack in terms of imperative justice. And I think you're right, though. It crystallizes. The clearest expression is not the Nixon era, though. I agree with you. The clearest expression of it is Reagan. Is Reagan era. Reagan puts into office on the Civil Rights Commission, people who don't believe in civil rights.
Well, you know,
on the Equal Opportunity Commission, people who don't believe in equal opportunity.
Maybe the the precursors to Nixon were in the shadow still of the movements, and it was socially a little bit risky to be so high or just so blatant, right, is what took place with the Reagan era.
Well, yeah, I think you're right there. But I think that, you know, if you listen, there is a new racial politics and a new discourse. For instance, any movements towards reparative justice. My father, for instance, was born in 1926 as a young man. Could not dream of playing Major League Baseball. Could not really dream of going to college. Could not dream. He was a Richmonder from a soda fountain with a white person. Could not really, you know, in terms of realizing his dreams, really think of being anything other than probably a skilled laborer within the black Richmond community. The one thing that began to open up possibilities for my father, who's still living, praise the Lord, is World War II, in which he had the privilege of fighting for equality, justice, and equal opportunity for Europeans and for European Americans in the various theaters around the world in a segregated army. Because the army, of course, wasn't desegregated until well after World War II. So he comes home from World War II, gets on the GI Bill and goes to RCA School for Electronics to get into the beginning radio and television industry, graduates at the top of his class and then is white-balled or black-balled, depending on how you use language, from the industry, and never gets into that industry, and kind of settles back into being an auto body mechanic, because this was what was available to African Americans during that era. And so we're not talking about a million years ago. Talking about my own personal family history. And yet we have, in this country, you have, particularly now, on college campuses, this notion that all discrimination is past, that all wounds are healed, that the problem in American society for that 30% underclass is essentially the problems of lack of character and a lack of appropriate culture among those folks. That's the problem. Okay? It's called the culture of dependency thesis. And you have, any of you familiar with Charles Murray's book, Losing Ground? No? No? Okay. That's good. That's a terrible book. The fact that you're unfamiliar with it means there's hope. But essentially, Murray argues that all of what you might call great society ventures, all great society public policy changes, are what is known in the trade as pejoristic. That is, having the quality of making the lives and aspects and conditions worse rather than better. Pejoristic, in other words, is the opposite of amelioristic, you know, making things better. So that's Murray. And Murray, of course, has caught the ear of Reagan, Bush, and even, to a certain extent, the Clinton administration, that is now talking about welfare reform and cutting off aid to women with children after a certain number of children or after a certain period of time, without thinking about the fact that, you know, who will be hurt most by that? Children. Okay, and even if you say the mothers and fathers are either irresponsible or lazy, in fact, who pays for that irresponsibility and laziness? The children, you know. So that I have some problems with the Clinton administration, particularly when people are quarreling over the $9 billion we're going to put in welfare, when each stealth bomber itself costs $4 billion. In fact, we have a military-industrial complex that consumes $450 billion in our gross national product. You take a look at that, $450 billion, which we're still throwing down the well, even though the Russians have thrown in the towel, and people who are quarreling over $9 billion. So essentially what I'm saying, not so much in this book, but in the next one, is our values are wrong. That in fact, if you shrunk the values of America into any American household, you would realize that, you know, the husband and wife would probably shoot each other and or the kids, or the house would be repossessed within, you know, 30 days. Because how we use our money, how, you know, what projects are important in this country are skewed right now. And that's kind of where I'm at as a social critic. My first career was in the practice of law. And to be frank with you, I was so disgusted by myself and other lawyers who never talked about justice that I retired. Because I couldn't get a heartbeat from most attorneys about the level of injustice in our society. Just not interested. Which means that they're good Americans. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go on
and on. Well, that's my question. You know, where do we start with all this? This week I've heard in, you know, some of the sessions about the country and how it was founded and how, you know, we basically living a lie based on, you know, all of the hurtful things that have been done. And it does make you think this is overwhelming. You know, how does it ever get turned around?
That's a very good question, and my location, of course, is in theological education. And the reason why, I can tell you right clearly, is because I, you know, even as an attorney, I always went to church, I always listened very carefully to the minister, and what I discover is most ministers don't engage in anything like what you might call social critical analysis. Who was one of the greatest opponents of the Equal Rights Amendment at the church? Mm-hmm. And particularly the Evangelical Church, of which I've been a member of. And the Equal Rights Amendment essentially wanted women to get paid dollar for dollar rather than the 60 cents on the dollar that women get paid for the same work as men. So I would say, Dolores, that one of the best places to begin is in the church, because the church is one of the few institutions in society that can talk about private religious, philosophical, ethical, and psychological matters the state can't interfere in. Plus, the church does not have to be afraid of being biblical or religious. You know, you can't get up in the middle of teaching your class in school and confess Jesus Christ as your Savior and go on about that rather than the Spanish lesson you're supposed to teach as a Spanish teacher. You can do that in your church. You can talk about what does it mean to be a Christian? What does it mean for Jesus to be your Lord and Savior in a world in which there is such oppression? You can do that in a church. You can do it without apologizing. And you can rally people to address some of the problems in the community that you see around you. And that's my suggestion on that. Because the church still, in an increasingly alienated world, is the one center that puts people back together again. You know, the family is disintegrated. The schools have basically disintegrated to a very large extent. The arena, the political arena, is cacophony. A bunch of voices. Nobody's got any vision. So how do you begin to, you know, knit back those unraveled sleeves? I would say in the church. That's why I'm, you know, professor of church and society. That's my bias. I could be dead wrong, but that's where I'm at, and that's what I've recommended.
I was naming at the session this morning that when you referred to the three reasons people are at church, one was it social, or why are religious people?
Extrinsic, and then quest, I guess. I don't know.
But was it that what I got from you was one of the predominant reasons we're at church is for social,
extrinsic reasons? We don't want to go to hell.
We don't want to go to hell. Or, and it's a
or
social.
Or we want to go to heaven, or we want to hobnob with the right people, or whatever. I mean, it seems to be the dominant. reason.
In fact, as a church is not a